You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
CJLO, I'm Shauna Lee Marie. BC sockeye salmon may be at risk of extinction after a rock slide in Fraser River continues to block regular migration routes. Files obtained by the CBC News include scientists warning of extinction. The Fraser River has been blocked since early June. Provincial officials have attempted to release the blockage with helicopters but were unable to clear it. Experts are calling on BC to declare a state of emergency. In other news, Quebec's health minister is calling on the province to allow medical-assisted dying. Danielle McCann delivered a speech Monday morning to call for public consultations and to release an injury report on how assisted dying could be rolled out. Among several recommendations, the report is calling for advanced consent capabilities for patients at the end of their lives. The Poe's Secret Community Art Project is continuing this week. The Concordia community is invited to drop a secret message into the CSU office mailbox in room 711 at the Hall Building. After enough anonymous secrets are collected, they will be disseminated around campus. To hear more about the newscast and learn more about the news team, visit cjlo.com/news.
Hello and welcome to CJLO 1690 AM. You're listening to Cinema Smackdown, starring me, Michael Brody, and my good friend...
And no one else at all.
All right, fine. You shall remain anonymous for this episode. I will leave it to the...
I just come in here to empty out the waste paper baskets.
And yet I can't get you to shut up. Fine, we'll go with that this week only.
I keep plugging my headphones into the board and... I just can't help myself.
You can be my janitorial co-host, giving us a fresh take on whatever subject I'm on about, but always through the lens of your career of picking up trash.
Yeah, and asking, so who was it who blocked the toilet this week?
It's definitely, I'm not going to go there. Yeah. I had so many easy jokes, and you know what?
No, and so much potential for insult.
Let's keep it
any
classy.
Number of people.
Yeah. Let's keep it classy. Hey, here's an interesting thing. This is approximately our 50th episode as a new version of the show, which was when we completely abandoned the original format.
After we wrestled control.
Exactly.
Away.
So this is approximately our 50th episode. I've gone back and counted.
Has anyone found Tessa's body yet?
she'll resurface for an eventual, end of year thought and or some other special.
I just want to make sure her dental records aren't on file anywhere because I don't want to get burned for this one.
All right. Well, just this once, we'll keep your name out of it.
Okay.
And this is approximately our 50th anniversary episode. We've done this nearly a full year now where I've been in control of the board. We've been choosing the topics. Nobody else is taking advantage of this. I mean, Tess did come in about four times this year whenever she had an event to promote and or people that she wanted to personally interview. But other than that, it's been about 46 weeks of
the training wheels are officially off.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're 2 weeks out from our full year, so we're pretty good. It's a funny thing is 50 is a great number to note, but of course, 52 equals a year. So, yeah, interesting.
I'm still
waiting
for that first paycheck to clear.
Oh, really?
When's that coming?
I mean, they've been so generous with me. I don't really know what the problem is. We'll forward it to your union leader at the janitorial staff.
Okay, good.
You?
Yeah,
they'll figure this out. The unions are pretty good about making sure that everybody's taken care of.
Unfortunately, I have to buy everything at the union store, so you can't really eat plumber's helpers too much.
Yeah, but the canteen is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
They've got some great stuff in there.
Yeah, hopefully not too recycled.
All right. Apropos of nothing, let's talk about this week's topic. So the title of our episode this week is Notable Directing Duos Not Named Coen. So everyone knows that the Coen brothers are pretty much the two most famous guys who make movies as a team, as a directing team. Of course, they weren't known to be a directing team for the first 17 films of their career.
Yeah, that would have been because of the Directors Guild rules that they were a little inflexible at the time.
Yeah, and so they, but they were well known outside of the credits of their actual films as having co-created everything. Of course, they also
Although
write
it,
and
it did cause confusion with a number of actors who did comment at the time. It's like, wait, who do I talk to for a direction? I'm like, eh, either one, it'll be fine. Direct, they share a brain.
Direct your comments to Mr. Roderick James.
Yes,
he'll let you know what needs to be done. So the Coen brothers are the most famous, but there are literally two or three dozen other guys out there, or gals, who...
Or gals who used to be guys.
That's right. Who are also putting together their own work, and I have assembled a list of things that are worth talking about. And in a lot of cases, as I like to say, whenever we talk about a large group of information, get your pencil or pen ready and write some of these titles down. They're well worth your time. So... unknown co-host of the week who works in the janitorial staff. I hear that you watched a movie last night by a directing team, or perhaps two directing teams, one of which we could talk about somewhat at length, and the other I don't think we should say one word about.
Exactly, yeah.
Other than to highly recommend it. So the first directing team I want to mention are these two gentlemen named Zach Lipovsky. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right. Zach Lipovsky and Adam B. Stein, who unveiled a movie. It came out this year, 2019, but it has a 2018 tag on it, probably because it was shown at a festival or something.
Yeah,
last
the,
year.
The festival ones are always a little dodgy
but
as
it
far
was,
as the year goes.
It was released in fall of 2019.
Yeah, exactly. So. It's like, if it got its wide release in September of... of this year, then I would not call it a 2019
film. Nope, and yet I just go by the IMDb dates.
Yeah, if it got projected on the side of someone's refrigerator as a test run in the year, they kind of are a little too zealous in saying that's the year it was first shown to people. So that's the year the film is.
Annoying but true. So Zach Lipovsky and Adam B. Stein directed a movie this year called Freaks. Terrible title because, of course, there's a much more famous movie called Freaks.
Yeah.
But regardless of the bad
the title...
The title
is my least favorite thing about the film. The rest of the film I kind of loved.
Here's the thing. Freaks, without getting into the actual plot, because I just want to recommend that everybody everywhere
see
this movie.
Yeah, by all means, try to watch this cold.
Yeah. No trailer. No synopsis. Just go see Freaks. Here's what I will say about
preferably
it.
Preferably don't even look up who's in it.
Yep. Contextually, or in terms of what the tone of this movie is... It's a really smart film that will make you ask questions throughout the running time and will keep delivering answers that will give you more interesting questions to answer all the way to the end. And it is a subtle film, so you really need to give it your full attention.
It hits you with one of those, okay, I'm not sure what's going on here, what the relationships are, what anything is happening. Is I just hope that this goes somewhere interesting. Mm-hmm. I hope it makes sense because there are certainly films like that that kind of throw you out to sea and say, hey, figure this out as it goes along. And then you figure it out and it's garbage.
Right. No, and there are great movies in the sense that there are plenty of films that have a great, great question mark on them. What's this going to be? What's this going to be? And as you just said, and then you get to the answer and you go,
Oh, it's that. How
the journey's great, and then the destination is terrible.
Whereas the destination, this one, I was in love.
It's spot on. It is a spot on film. It's really happy with
where it went.
I actually caught this one in the cinema in the 1 week that it played in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
And I was really, really happy to have seen it. And I immediately told 5 people to go catch it. They all thought my review made it sound extremely appealing, and then it was gone before any of them could get there. That the next Friday it was gone, which was such a shame.
Yeah, I spent about the first 10 minutes going, is this going to win me over? Is this going to win me over?
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kept getting better and better until I was really very happy.
Nice. So again, no details, but if you have a chance, see Freaks, which again, if you look on
the
IMDb,
2019,
it has a 2018 tag, but it's a 2019 movie. It's just a full-on recommendation. Just watch it as cold as possible. That is our first directing team. These guys haven't made any other films. They have directed a lot of bad television, which I'm sure they would acknowledge. It's children's TV. A lot of children's TV.
Well,
So I don't mean
children's
bad.
TV. Only hacks work in children's TV. That and, well, you know, people who quit that and became plumbers like me.
Yeah. You said it, my janitor friend. So the other film I believe you watched last night, I don't have the director's name.
And when
name
I say last
me.
Night, I mean several hours ago.
I know.
Because it was the my first thing I did this morning. I got up at an unseemly early hour and just started watching movies. So.
That movie is called Ready or Not, another film whose title I do not approve of.
Given what the film is about, that's fine. That one's
yeah,
fine.
But fine. It doesn't make for good titles. It's unremarkable. It's an unremarkable title. It could go. That could be a romantic comedy. It could be an adventure film.
It refers
literally
specifically
anything.
To the game that is played in this
right
in this film. So.
So, Ready or Not, another highly recommended movie that I would definitely say be very careful how much you learn about this film. A little less scary than Freaks. You really don't want to know anything about Freaks. But with Ready or Not, why don't you give us a quick summation doesn't kill anything.
Okay, doesn't kill anything. Centers on a girl who is marrying into a rich family. And this family... Their history is their fortune came from ancestors who made games, board games, etc., invested in gaming things. And one of the family traditions is when you marry to the family, you have to play a game with them on your wedding night. And this is randomly selected from a box of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of the games they play are pretty mundane. Chess, checkers, whatever. However, there's one card where the game has more dire consequences.
Right. And what are the odds that one's going to get pulled?
Yeah, you know. Well, luckily she pulled Twister, and the entire movie is them playing Twister.
So the directors of this film are Matt Bettinelli, if I'm pronouncing that right. It's Bettinelli Ulpin and Tyler Gillett. They are a directing team who put this together. They did not write this film. Unlike Freaks was written by the same people who directed it. I should probably note that. There's directing teams and there's writing directing teams.
Right.
So it's a little bit different. So Ready or Not is one of those trashy B movies that is so winning
in its
way.
So willing to be a dark comedy as
it
well.
It fully embraces its exploitation roots. It is having the best time ever.
Oh yeah, they're having fun. Yeah. I'm having fun watching it.
Yeah, it's a pretty infectious film in that sense of just okay. Do I dare get on board the concept? Well, okay, I'm gonna give the movie a little rope and see what happens. And then you're like, oh, that was pretty good. Oh, that's pretty good. And then it just gets. I just got happier and happier as that film went on.
The one minor quibble I have with it is that it stinks of spec script. Mm-hmm. In that you said they didn't write it, and that makes sense to me because. It feels like a script that bounced around Hollywood for a while until someone decided, hey, you know, we should make this. You could probably make it pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has one of those opening sequences that kind of tells you what the tone of the film is going to be down the
scene.
Road. Yeah, I wish it wasn't there because I like it better when it's
funny.
A slow burn.
I have recommended to multiple people that if they want to watch it, skip to blank minute. I didn't tell them what minute, but no one's going
to
do that.
I actually had that thought because I want to show it to people. And I've done this on a couple of occasions before I've skipped.
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium's the
big
one.
Oh, and Dark City.
Dark City's another one, yeah.
They have these, let us over-explain the concept to you before we get started.
Yes, here's the premise of the world we're building before we actually show you the world we're building.
It's been
How about you just build the world?
It's been a while since I have mentioned this, but I will mention it again because I always think this bears mentioning. Dark City has two cuts. There is the theatrical cut, which has this horrible opening narration leading up to a scene of the main character waking up in a bathtub. I recommend to any... Sorry, to get to the point of that. And then there's a director's cut, which omits that narration and adds in a lot of deleted scenes, like previously deleted scenes. I recommend to anyone who's ever considering watching Dark City, do not go anywhere near that horrible director's cut in which he adds back about 15 minutes of garbage and ruins the pace of the movie. I recommend you watch the theatrical cut, but mute the film until you see a guy sit up in a bathtub.
Right. Likewise with Equilibrium, I showed it to so many people that I got very good at fading in the sound that completely eliminated the narration. Fading in the sound as we start with the image of a guy looking at a painting. That's where the movie actually begins.
It's true. And these movies, you can tell it's a producer or studio mandate of, this is hard to understand. Explains everything.
With Ready or Not, that opening scene, to me, smells like the writer trick when you're writing a spec script.
Yes, yes.
That you want to do something that will grab people immediately because you don't want them to get bored when the first 15 pages of your script is set up.
Well, speaking of getting bored, we're going to cut to a commercial and come back in about a minute.
Are you interested in comics? Wonder where all the movies come from? Already a fan of the genre but want to dig deeper? Librairie Crossover Comics is here to help. From the most popular Marvel and DC comics to independent gems, we want to show off the variety that's available to you. Gaming and community are also important to us, with Magic the Gathering, Dungeons & Dragons, and book club events happening regularly. Plus, we're open 7 days a week, located near Metro Lionel Creux at 3560 Notre Dame West. Stop by for a visit or check crossovercomics.ca for more info.
For the best new music from around the globe, with a respectful nod to the musical pioneers of the past and a whole lot more, join me, Danny Payne, on The Pressure Drop every Monday at 5 on CGLO 1690 AM or CGLO.com.
Well, thank you, custodial staff, for taking care of opening that window for me. It was sweltering hot in this room, and you are now earning your paycheck.
No, that's my job, taking care of air conditioning.
So, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM. You're listening to Cinema Smackdown, where today we are talking about notable directing duos not named Coen. Even though we did kind of talk about them a little bit at the top, but we didn't really get into their filmography, so I think that's what's important.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's move on from our...
Unfortunately, this also excludes any directors who have... or Coen spelled with an H. So, sorry, guys, you're left out too.
There's no duos. There is a Joel Cohen.
Yeah, well, if he ever co-directs something, well, guess what? We're not talking about you.
Well,
sorry.
He did direct the delightful Holmes and Watson comedy from last year, which is in its own way a movie about a duo. You highly recommended that. Am I mistaken? That's my recollection.
Yeah, no, and in the theme of duos, I threw up twice watching that film.
Yeah. We have previously in the at the beginning of the show, we talked about a movie called Freaks and a movie called Ready or Not, both of which are highly, highly recommended for this year's additions to the canon of good film or really entertaining movies that you have to think about or just be.
Yeah, well, I think you're going to be making both of our best of the year list in yet another pretty poor year for film in general.
I was pretty disappointed with 2018's crop, but as I look into, I fully put my to date, because there is 31 days left of this year, my to date list of best movies, and it's half as many films as last year.
Well, I haven't watched it yet, but I fully expect that 18-hour cut of The Irishman will win me over.
Yes, you're going to greatly enjoy that made-for-TV miniseries that feels like it was shot for exactly that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it argued many a time now in critical essays on it, and Scorsese responding to, no, it shouldn't have been a TV show, and you watch it and you go, how is this not a TV show?
Yeah, I saw the running time, which is actually 3.5 hours, and it's like, what?
Oh, I saw it. But we're not getting into that today because we're talking about directing duos. And while De Niro probably directed half those scenes, we're not going to count that one. Let's get to our next directing duo of note. I have a couple I really want to talk through today. And one of them, this is a quicker one, is Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are interesting directing duo. They are mostly guys who have been bang on with what they've done, with only an exception or two from me. And, of course, those are their biggest successes.
Well, I am, of course, a tremendous fan of their triple director feature called Solo.
Yeah. See, that's what you get to that after you talk about the successes. But these two guys started out on a TV show called Clone High in the early 2000s, which is actually quite an excellent animated show. It doesn't really give you the impression these guys are going to go on to become powerhouse film directors, but it is an interesting cartoon show. And following that, they got their, I think their directorial debut is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is magnificent on so many levels. I've been begging you to watch this movie for, what, 8 years?
Yeah,
stars your favorite actor in his best performance, which is to say Bill Hader, is amazing in that movie. And as animated films go, it's really clever and inventive. And as hard as I recommend Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, I quintuple double down on pretend there is no sequel, because that sequel is borderline offensive in what it does to the original material.
Well, they didn't do it, though. They're not.
They worked on it.
They did work on it? Okay.
They didn't direct it, but they worked on it. It's just, it's wrong. You watch the film, you go 5 minutes in, you go, well, this isn't right. This is not the right story to tell with these characters. And they just bore into this terrible, terrible story. But
well,
the first
guys,
movie is a
guys, obviously, learn a lesson from The Incredibles 2, why don't you?
The Incredibles 2 is just blah.
It's exactly.
Not a,
okay.
It's not a bad movie. It's just a blah.
So you
adventure.
Dislike the sequel to Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs worse than The Incredibles 2?
Oh, it is a cinematic travesty.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, no, it's a piece of garbage. It fundamentally misunderstands the lessons the character learns in the first movie. It just, the movie, like many stories, ends with him realizing some things and making some changes in the way he handles everything going forward in his life. And then the sequel starts. Oh, he just throws those lessons away.
Yeah.
Immediately.
And it's like, what, 5 minutes later, I think?
It is 1 minute later.
Wow.
It is the next minute. And it's just baffling and terrible. It feels entirely
embarrassed. Well, you got zapped in the face by one of those Men in Black devices. And just
yeah. So they directed, Lord and Miller directed Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. They moved on to live action with the 221 Jump Street movies, which are shockingly entertaining, considering how much I dislike the two leads. And I really,
right.
really dislike them.
it's the number one reason I haven't seen them.
Yeah, but they are magical films. They have... There's just something special about them. And the reality is, of course, you mentioned the Solo movie, these movies are clearly, I don't know, 25% improvised with help from the directors. They stand there on set encouraging oddball improvisation, which apparently happened throughout their filming of the Solo movie, which was what led to them being fired from that
And apparently
movie.
Aaron Eckhart wasn't good at it, so they brought in a coach. To help him improvise.
Aaron Eckhart is not in that movie.
Wait, who am I? What the hell? Okay, I've screwed up the
Aaron
name.
Aaron Reich.
Oh, okay, fine.
Aldrich.
Oh.
That's a human whose name we probably don't need to know because Solo ruined his career.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah. I was going to memorize his name, but then, we'll never hear from this guy again.
So Lord and Miller made 21 Jump Street 1 and 2, 21 and 22 Jump Street, terrible sequel title, but still sort of funny. And then they made the Lego movie somewhere in there.
Right.
Now, the Lego movie is beloved by everyone
except you.
Except me. Yeah. I don't get it. I don't understand that journey. I did appreciate Lego Batman within that film. I did not appreciate Lego Batman on his own. But,
well, I do remember having to explain to people, especially when the Everything Is Awesome song got nominated for an Oscar and was performed Oscar night. It's like, no, actually, within the context of the film, this is extremely ironic and dystopian.
Yes. Yeah. I got that. I understood
the gist of it. But people weren't familiar with the source material. It's like, oh, this is such a shallow song. It's like, no, you need to see it within context.
I just wasn't won over by the Lego movie, and the more I had to watch static blocks blockily walking around, the less enthusiastic I got about it. It was almost like having to watch the running time go down because I so didn't enjoy this pretend stop motion movie.
Right.
If
it had been made with real Lego instead of computer animated Lego, I would have been much more impressed by it, but they would still be filming it as well.
Yeah.
So.
Well, much like a Power Rangers movie, there's just a lack of, I can't connect with these blocks as well as I can. The same with a Power Rangers movie where you just have these immobile faces that people are talking.
Right. I should mention also they nominated the wrong song from that film for an Oscar. Because
you mean the Batman song?
They should have used a Batman song. The Batman song was amazing.
Yes, I agree. So that's what I'm saying. I it's not like I don't like the Lego movie at all. I don't like it, but I do understand why it's loved. Mm. And I have said this before, and I will say this again. There is a sequel to the Lego movie, much like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which even if you are the number one fan in the world of the Lego movie, I cannot believe you watched that sequel and didn't go, well, they shouldn't have made this. It's so hollow. It feels like a desperate attempt to just keep telling the same story, which is never a great idea with a sequel. You gotta Temple of Doom it up. Do something weird and different if you're going to tell a second story with the same characters. That's my opinion. But we all learned that lesson on Another Stakeout.
I thought we already learned it on Another 48 Hours, but okay.
And as a final note for Lord and Miller, they didn't direct, but wow, are their fingerprints all over Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which just feels so entirely like it's their work. In the final film, only one of them is credited with screenplay, but on every single previous listing of credits, they're both listed. So you know both of these guys did a fair amount of work on that film. I'm a big fan of Into the Spider-Verse. It was a shockingly good movie, considering how played out Spider-Man is and how the idea of 19 versions of him in a film just sounded terrible.
It did an excellent version job of reinterpreting his relationship with bagels.
Oh my God, the finest scene in any movie in 5 years. That guy, that Spider-Man is now and forever my Spider-Man.
Oh yeah, pudgy loser Spider-Man is amazing.
Pudgy loser old Spider-Man. I mean, he's...
Oh, and Jewish, by the way.
Yeah, there's always if you been caught an that, element of that in
the mythology. He is also the Jewish Spider-Man. Yeah.
Although he is not specifically Jewish. There's always element of it.
No, we see a moment from his wedding.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they step on a glass,
yep,
don't they?
Yep, for me, that means Jewish.
I mean, it's from another universe. Who knows what their culture is really like?
The first Spider-Man we see in there is also with blonde Spider-Man, so...
Well, moving on from Lord and Miller, who make delightful movies that that really, really entertain the whole family, I am going to talk about a directing duo that make movies that really don't appeal to that kind of wider market. I'm talking about these two gentlemen named Alexandre Boussillot and Julien Marie, who burst onto the scene. They're two French directors who burst on the scene in 2007 with a little movie called A l'Intérieur, or Inside.
My favorite versus movie of all time.
Yes, the knockdown, drag-out versus all-time champion movie of two people wanting to murder each other.
I love a subgenre that I've identified. I call it versus movies, where it's just two characters going at each other with everything they've got for the whole movie.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of them out there, but none of them are more extreme than A l'Intérieur.
Yeah, there's really no way to warn you enough that if you are sensitive, you can never watch A l'Intérieur. It is too intense, too violent.
I brought it over to show friends of mine, and I watched two grown men basically hide under pillows while they were watching this movie.
Yeah, it is a masterpiece of discomfort. And it's very engaging, but it is a rough, rough movie. It is, I love to use the word exploitation. It is an exploitation movie, but it is such an artfully made movie that it crosses over into being cinema, being film. It's a pretty rough movie.
It's the film that makes me go, when, you know, I don't give a damn about mixed martial arts or boxing, but there are people who get a real thrill out of it.
Yeah.
This film gives me that thrill.
I get it. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sick enough to find this a very enjoyable night out at the movies.
Yeah.
Most people will be very upset by this film, though.
Highest recommendation with massive warnings on it of, you know, parental advisory. Be very careful if you're planning to watch this film. So these two guys have gone on to make other movies. They have made two other French films, and then they have come on over to America. So the two other French films they made are interesting movies, but they're not on the level of A l'Intérieur. So they made a movie called Livid. I think that's the same title in French, but I actually don't even know how that would be pronounced. Livid. Which is actually kind of a classy movie about a group of people in an abandoned building. It's got a lot of tension. There's a lot. It's sort of a ghost story, but it's very, very well made, but it of course doesn't reach the heights of their previous knockdown, drag-out massacre film. So it's a bit of a come down from their previous work. Although I can't say it's not a good movie. It's quite well made. They really, cinematically, they have a great eye as a duo. And after that, they made another film I would call much more of an exploitation film. It's called Among the Living. And I really should have written down the French title because it's quite different. It's more, the French title is more like In Their Tired Eyes or something like that. But that's Dans Leurs Yeux something. I don't quite remember. And that, it's kind of like the concept for It without any supernatural material. There is a creepy murderer in a clown mask that three children stumble upon, and they escape, and he follows them home and does terrible, terrible things to them and their families, to the point where you say, I cannot believe I'm watching a movie with children in it where this much awful stuff happens. Hmm. And it's not exactly a successful movie, but it has so many moments. You know those films, you're like, interesting failure, but wow, I'll watch whatever you do next, because this is, it's just, conceptually, not a lot happens. But it's still kind of a minor masterpiece. As I said, it's called Among the Living. And finally, they came to America and made a movie called Leatherface. They directed a random 12th sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Are we legitimately up to 12 at this point?
I don't know.
Could be.
It's so many in. This one features Lily Taylor and Stephen Dorff. Lily Taylor playing the matriarch.
I so wanted you to say Steven Tyler.
the matriarch. She plays the matriarch of the, I forget their names. They have a funny cannibal name family. But anyway, the family. And Stephen Dorff plays a wayward sheriff trying to catch up with their shenanigans. It's a terrible, terrible movie. It's kind of a junk horror film with weird, kind of stilted performances. But there's, again, it's these two directors, so there's some brilliant photography in it and some really hardcore violence moments. So I don't recommend this movie, but I'll never give up on them.
Do they have any interesting casting for the family?
I don't recall. I saw this movie a couple years ago. I just remember thinking, this isn't really good, but keep working, guys. I hope you keep getting paid.
Because, you know, after Arlie Ermey, it's a hard act to top.
Absolutely.
Getting someone weird and interesting.
Didn't I just say Stephen Dorff?
Well, yeah, exactly.
All right, so that's Bustillo and Marie, who are a wonderful, weird directing duo. All of their work is interesting, if not always successful. Did you have anybody you wanted to bring up before I move on, or you just want to keep
commenting? No, I did want to make sure you got the inside guys.
Yeah. I will remind the listeners, you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. We are talking about notable directing duos not named Coen this afternoon on our little show that's called Cinema Smackdown.
It is an unusual phenomenon in general of getting more than one person to... Yeah, there are plenty of
collaborators.
Films, yeah, there are plenty of films out there that have multiple directors, but it's usually directors working on their own sequences. So, you know, something like a Tora Tora Tora, for example, which has some big-name directors, but they're off doing individual segments that have nothing to do with the work of the other
directors. Well, essentially, that's when you wind up having an anthology movie, even if you don't advertise it as an anthology movie, because
their sequences don't
connect.
Also, the anthology movie. But I was thinking of Tora 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 in particular, because there are Japanese sequences that needed a Japanese director and English sequences that needed a different director. So, you know, there are practical reasons to split it up. One of the multiple director ones as well that comes to mind is Casino Royale, which is a film that completely switches tones every half hour because, well, a different director did this part.
Yeah. The lauded and well-loved.
Yeah, I'm talking about the 1967 version of Casino Royale, not the...
Well-hated for good reasons.
Yeah, yeah. No, I certainly not a fan, even though I'm a James Bond uber fan. That one's rough to sit through.
It's rough. It is rough. It was only when I read about it did I realize that in that film, there is only really one actor playing James Bond. Even though it is presented like 40 people are playing.
Yeah, they
him.
Try to present it that way. It's a film that is so muddled, even the advertisers didn't know what the hell was going on with it. So they just said, look, everyone's playing James Bond. And it's not really what the film is about. It only makes sense for the first about 20 minutes, which are directed by John Huston, and it goes so far off the rails. It's
right. Oh, good lord.
So the idea of having multiple directors or collaborating directors directing the whole thing together is unusual, because you usually have to have the one guy to go, yes, that chair, yes, that lens, yes, that, you know, making all the
this
minutiae.
Tone, yes.
Yeah.
It might be one of those films where they just didn't let them see other people's footage.
that could be the case, yeah.
Moving on, let's talk about two guys whose work I'm not crazy about and yet is always interesting, which is the Spierig brothers, Michael and Peter Spierig. They are, I believe, New Zealand? I really should have done better research.
Oh, right. Yes, I know
who
you're talking
about. So they burst onto the scene with an incredibly slick-looking, but
very low budget.
Incredibly slick-looking, despite not having any money invested in it, a movie called Undead, which is so misleading as a title.
Yeah.
It's not a zombie movie. It's much
it's
more
a hodgepodge
of an alien
science
film.
Fiction horror film.
Yeah, and not great. But
no,
it has
it's not
potential.
Great. But it's inventive, yeah. And they came up with some amazing low budget solutions to make it look much more expensive. Than
it looks
actually
spectacular,
is.
And it really felt like an early Peter Jackson film. Not
it
to
has
the
that
same
sensibility.
Degree,
yeah,
not to the
yeah.
Same
it has that. There's something in the water in New Zealand,
so,
I guess.
And I didn't really love that movie, and I didn't think much of them at the time. But then a couple of years later, they put out a movie called Daybreakers, which I really enjoyed. That's the all vampires
right.
all the time movie.
Yeah, yeah.
with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe and a few other people. That movie is bleak in an interesting way. And let's be clear. It's a little self-congratulatory near the end. Like, look what we did. The world is so much better now. And I thought, I love it when they stay in their concept as more than just expand the world a little too much. The resolution in that movie is just okay. It's a little, let's make the audience happy as opposed to let's do the right movie. But it's still
notable.
That
one didn't win me over either, okay. But it's a little more of a cohesive film.
It's very cohesive. Yeah. It's also a little brutal in that there's characters in it you go, well, clearly this character is someone we're going to root for. Oh, they're dead. I always admire that. They do a few of those in Daybreakers. They went on to make a film called Predestination, which is a causal loop movie like no other. And I really didn't enjoy Predestination, but I cannot fault it for being the movie it wants to be. It's one of those films that they're taking such a shot with that one that you just have to give them a quiet round of applause at the end. They made the right movie that they wanted to make. It just wasn't for me. But that's Predestination. And finally, of late, they made a Saw sequel called Jigsaw, which was an attempt to reboot
the
franchise.
Oh, that was them. Okay.
And it's not good.
Oh, yeah. Now, see, I'm a fan of the Saw series, but I have not watched
Jigsaw
yet.
Here's the thing. It's not awful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, they made, I want to say, 7 Saw movies?
Yeah.
Okay. And the 7th movie doesn't really have an ending. It doesn't feel particularly final. But they were saying, this is the end of Saw. Okay. And then they waited 6 years, and they put out this movie called Jigsaw, which literally just feels like the next film. So it's not reboot on any level. It isn't reinventing the concept. And it does not end on a note where you go, wow, I'm so excited to see more of this. It's just, oh yeah, it's the next one.
Well, Saw 7 kind of ended it, and then, you know, several years later, they basically announced, yeah, we're going to start up the Saw series again, but we don't actually know what we're going to do.
Right.
Which is when I called my agent and said, get me a meeting.
Well, that worked out great.
Exactly. I had my own concept because I was a bit of a super fan for the Saw series. And
they are very smart movies.
I had a concept of one of the loose ends that could have been exploited for a new series.
Well, as you may or may not know, their attempt to reboot failed, and now the movie series is fully being rebooted by Chris Rock.
Really?
Chris Rock wrote and is starring in a new Saw movie, which will be coming out in the somewhat near future. And by all accounts, it's a really interesting film.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. I don't dislike Chris Rock. I'm curious to see what his take will be. I'm hoping it's not a comedy. He's an interesting dramatic actor in the very few times I've seen him do drama, including Nurse Betty, where he was.
Oh yeah,
really,
yeah, no, Nurse Betty, yeah,
really something. He gives an uncomfortable performance in Nurse Betty. Like, I was riveted by how uncomfortable he made me in that.
Yeah,
movie.
Him and Morgan Freeman as kind of buddy hitmen,
and
he is so irritating. You're wondering why these guys aren't just going to kill each other at any given moment. You're on edge watching their scenes all the time. And
yeah,
then you find out...
It's a good movie.
You find out why.
Yeah, I'm
great.
Very fond of Nurse Betty. It's another film, though, that walks that line right between, is this good or am I going to hate this? It tries to be magical in places and also like incredibly violent. And so it's a strange film. It's almost a feel.
I will never like a Renée Zellweger film as much as that one.
Exactly, exactly. It's a strange. It's a strange one at any rate. So that's the Spierig Brothers. Still interesting, but I kind of have never loved anything they've done. Although maybe I loved Daybreakers, even if you didn't. I'm a fan. I want to see what they do. I hope they get a chance to do something personal again. We'll see. Moving on from them to another horror duo, or guys who do stuff that's a little in that vein, is Marcus Dunstan and Patrick Melton. Now, to be clear, only one of these guys, and I didn't make a note, I think it's Dunstan, is the actual credited director. They're a writing team. They are the guys who wrote Feast. Remember Feast?
Oh, yes.
They didn't direct that, but ultimately they started directing movies. So they're the two guys who made Feast. Well documented on the Project Greenlight miniseries of them being picked to be the writers.
Yeah, I believe
that
was the season two one where they said, you know
three.
What?
It's three.
Okay, yeah, because
one and two were kind of failures. And
exactly.
They said, we should make a movie that makes money.
They said, yes, we should actually back something that's commercial.
Yeah. So they made a horror film. So these guys got picked because they have a lot of enthusiasm for the genre. Now, the Dunstan-Melton combination have written scripts for Feast and then four Saw movies. They wrote the bulk of the Saw series.
Oh, yeah.
Before moving on, yeah, they wrote 4, 5, 6, and the final chapter, which is quite a lot of Saw.
Yeah. They aren't the good ones, though.
I disagree.
I think their work
on those is interesting, and I can't remember which one it is. I think it's 6, where you and I saw that and said, wow, this suddenly got so much better. One of those is
okay,
quite a bit better.
I mean, they do blend together after a while, but
that's the problem.
4, 5, and 6 were about, how do we keep the series alive because we're kind of done after 3?
Yeah. Well, anyway, they're inventive guys. They are pretty good with traps and things, and then they took the exact same concept as Saw. And that's when I believe it's Dunstan's directing career started. He made a movie called The Collector. Now, here's the thing. I saw The Collector. It felt like a Saw retread because it is about traps and an evil guy. It doesn't have that moralistic thing happening in it. It had a spark of something interesting, but I didn't really like it. And a couple years later, they made a sequel together called The Collection. But The Collection is a masterpiece. It's a little exploitation film. It's essentially, The Collection is to The Collector what Aliens was to Alien. We're going to amp this up 1,000%. And the movie The Collection, which can be viewed without seeing the first movie, is a remarkably entertaining, very short movie. I think it's 80 minutes. It's one of those movies. It's just a rock'em sock'em version. It falls pretty well into the Saw concept. This is, for me, this is the best Saw movie, even though it's called The Collection. It has a very, very satisfying arc filled with lots of crazy traps and a fantastic ending. And these movies, a lot of the cases, like, it's a great ride, and you get to the end and you go, eh.
Right.
The Collection's one of those where I'm like, no, I am fully, fully satisfied by the ending of The Collection. And from what I can tell, they have directed another sequel to this called The Collected, which there's an IMDb page for it. There's a cast. It looks like it got made. I've had no full confirmation of this as opposed to it says it got made. So, but I don't know anything about its release date or anything along those lines. I'm just looking forward to it. I say this because in interviews of the last few years, they said it had been too long since The Collection to release a legitimate sequel. They were going to wind up having to do a reboot if ever, and that just sounded like death. But now it exists, so I'm very curious to see what ended up happening. And anyway, that's Dunstan and Melton. They're an interesting team. As I said, they don't fully fall under the directing duo category, but they make everything together. Much like, I think it's worth mentioning these two guys, at least the beginning of their careers, is Jeunet and Caro.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Who were originally co-credited as directors, but that started to shift when they came to America.
Well, yeah, Caro was more about the design elements of the film. However, the design was so integral to Jean-Pierre Jeunet's films that they're almost inseparable.
Yeah. What's interesting is that Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Marc Caro co-directed Delicatessen and The City of Lost Children, both of which are stunning,
fantastic,
dystopian masterpieces.
Yep.
They're gorgeous. They're intriguing. The best Ron Perlman performance you'll ever see, where Ron Perlman does an entire movie in French with a Russian accent convincingly. Quite astonishing.
And he's not buried under 10 tons of makeup and latex for a change, which is nice.
But he always looks that way in real life anyway.
Yeah, kind
of. If anybody kind of looks like they're wearing a plastic face, it's Ron Perlman. I say that with love, Ron. We love you. I have nothing but good feelings for him, especially after his stint on Sons of Anarchy, where he ruled the world for me for a few years of quite a crazy performance. I love him in that show. But we're talking about Jeanette Caro. So they did Delicatessen, City of Lost Children, then they came to America and made Alien Resurrection.
Right.
Which,
yeah,
by all rights, should have been a co-directing credit, but they moved Caro over simply to a design credit, which is kind of sad, but also, who really wants credit for that movie?
Yeah, well, there's probably also Directors Guild of America rules to adhere to. So,
well, we'll be back with a little bit more on Jeanette Caro after these brief messages from our very important sponsors.
Brewtopia is the premier brew pub in downtown Montreal, located on Crescent Street. A proud, locally owned business sourcing ingredients from local Quebec farms. The city's longest running open mic every Sunday night and trivia every Monday night. There's always something happening at Brewtopia Brew Pub. Visit brewtopia.net for more information. Brewtopia Brew Pub, brewing the flavors of fall.
Art? We can pop it. Indie? We can pop that too. Dream, synth, chamber, pop, pop, pop. Rock? It's already been pop.
The rest of us goes pop. Same awkward host, new concept, and time. Tune in Tuesdays at 7 p.m. for the best new music in all pop subgenres, only on CJLO 1690 AM.
We're gonna have so many feelings.
Welcome back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined today by the head of the custodial staff here at Concordia University. I never did catch your name, but because you're a janitor, we really don't need
it. Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
We are discussing notable directing duos not named Coen today, and I have not gotten a quarter of the way into my list so far, so I think we're going to do a follow-up
we'll do
one
10
of these
sequels
days.
In 2020.
We were still talking, when we took the break, we were talking about Jeanette and Caro films, and we only got up to the fact that they directed Delicatessen and City of Lost Children together, probably directed Alien Resurrection together, although they are separately credited on that film. What's interesting is, after that movie, they broke into two separate teams. So, Mark Caro did in fact direct a movie on his own. It is called Dante 101.
Right.
And that movie is unwatchable. It is unwatchable on a narrative level. It barely makes sense. It's extremely plodding. And frankly, it doesn't have the visual flair his other work has. And that was the whole point, is that Caro is the visual flair guy.
Right, right.
So it's kind of a sad attempt to launch
However,
a directing
Jeanette,
career.
When he went off on his own, he didn't lose much, if any, of his visual flair.
True.
His subsequent films are lovely to look at.
Yep, they are lovely to look at, and they are beloved by all mankind except me.
I thought you liked Amelie.
Oh, really? Amelie actually is at the bottom of my saccharin list. It's of it is a movie that is so sweet, it made me despise the main character. I actually think she's a terrible, terrible person, and I couldn't get behind the movie on that level of, but she's so awful, how come, you know, well, that's why I love the movie. No, I despise her. There was something so smug and self-satisfied about her character that within 10 minutes of that movie being on, I just started to get angry, and she just kept fueling my fire of rage.
I had no idea you disliked the film that much, because
Hate.
Because
it's Forrest Gump levels of how dare
we
you.
We saw it when it came out, and you were the one who convinced me, hey, I'm going to the new Jeanette film, drop what you're doing and come with me.
Right.
And I was like, I don't really know if I want to, and I was so glad I did, because I was delighted by that film.
Well, you drank the Kool-Aid that I did not
drink.
I did
indeed.
As I said, it is a beloved movie. It is many, many people's favorite all-time film. But it crossed the line for me into, why am I upset? And his continuing work has done that, with one exception. I am not a fan of his last two movies. He did Micmacs, which is intolerably happy. And I can't even remember the last one, but it's The Education of T.S. Privet or something along those lines.
You're missing one as well.
Skipping that one.
Okay.
So I despised those two films. Absolutely on every conceptual level. They did not work for me. They are attempts to make people happy no matter what, being super cute. They're nails on a chalkboard throughout. That's how I felt about those movies. However, his one exception is A Very Long Engagement, which right. is dark enough and interesting enough and certainly well-filmed. They're all mm-hmm. well-filmed. The man is an expert cinema... Everything that he, through his lens, chooses to put on camera is gorgeous. Put on film, it's gorgeous. But yeah, his sensibilities and mind, they parted ways at a certain point. Mind
so
you,
the
as
theme
I said,
of this
I like
episode
Very Long Engagement.
Is happy movies, go to hell, and torture porn movies, great.
I hate to say that on some occasions I find it much, much easier to see the light in a totally offensive exploitation film than I do in a movie that is attempting to tell me how beautiful the flowers are. It's just the way it is. If you're trying way too hard to say the world is beautiful, you're gonna lose me. But it's one of those things where with Jeunet, I'm so wary of having to sit through one of his films now because I feel like I'm gonna be lectured at about the beautiful meaning of life, and I just don't enjoy those movies. I want the struggle. I want something else. Any further thoughts on Jenna and Cairo?
No.
Fan of Dante 1?
Actually, that's one of those films I just never got around to seeing that one.
That's fine. It does, as far as I'm concerned, given its non-narrative structure, it's barely a movie. It's a little art film. It doesn't qualify as a plot-based story. It just mm-hmm. kind of sits there for most of the running time. But at any rate, let's move on from them to... Here's one that seems a little bit like, God, do we really have to talk about these guys? But it's the last 2 years of their careers is the most interesting. And that's guys who've been doing this for like 25 years, is a directing team of Bobby and Peter Farrelly, the Farrelly brothers.
Oh, dear.
Now, yeah, there's a whole middle period of... We both enjoyed the beginning of their career, and then the whole middle period is...
Yeah, the very, very beginning. Like, before they hit it big,
yes.
they did a film called Kingpin.
Yep.
Which is a disgusting, vulgar, horrible comedy that's kind of magic.
Yeah, exactly. It pushes the envelope so far.
By the time everyone else caught on... I was kind of done with them already.
Yeah, well, their whole middle career is so mediocre. But it's interesting is that now they've aged out and they've both become more interesting. So they started off with Dumber Dumber. Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber. Which is fine. It's so vulgar in places that it's kind of amazing what a hit it was.
Yeah.
But we don't need to say much about that one. Kingpin is much more interesting.
Jeff Daniels has a scene in that where everyone, Jeff Daniels in that film, Woody Harrelson in Kingpin, there's a few people who's like, wow, and you had a career after you did that scene.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Woody Harrelson seems bulletproof considering some of the stuff he's been in. Including Solo. at any rate, the Farrelly brothers followed up with their biggest big hit was probably Dumb and Dumber, but their second biggest hit was There's Something About Mary, which is a notable film despite its many, many flaws. But, I mean, that movie's been talked about to death. Then they have an entire middle period of their career, which I'm not even going to list the films. They're so, that didn't work. There's two notable movies in there for me that are not well-loved, but I still find them interesting conceptually, and that would be Shallow Hal, the movie where Jack Black dates a very thin, but not thin, Gwyneth Paltrow. There's something so strange about the underlying concept of that movie that when I watch it, I'm kind of mesmerized by what they're trying to tell me. And there's also probably their biggest failure as a film, which, if you ask me overall, does the movie work? I'd say no, but there's some magic in this film. It's the Heartbreak Kid remake with Ben Stiller, which, if you're a fan of the original, this movie is absolute blasphemy. It is crushing the original film under its boot heel. But there is something so interesting about what an absolute monster the female lead in this is, and the fact that they present her for 25 minutes as an angel and then reveal to you plot point by plot point that every single thing you have seen with her that seemed delightful is actually horrid. There's some great writing structure in that. It's really something. And I enjoyed the journey. That movie is, The Heartbreak Kid is overly long. I think it's over 2 hours. It feels like an 80-minute movie that has been stretched incomprehensibly out to a distant length. It is a failure of a film that I kind of have a soft spot for because it's really swinging for the fences. At any rate, what I really want to point out is that Peter Farrelly broke from his brother to make a movie 2 years ago that I absolutely despised, and that is Green Book. That movie, for all of its awards and people lauding it, it feels like it's supposed to be based on a true story, and it feels like the biggest lie I've ever seen put on film. And apparently the family of one of the two gentlemen presenting the movie has corroborated that everything you see in that movie is a fabrication. So when it felt fake,
except for
it
the
was.
Explosive diarrhea scene.
But here's the thing that's
interesting.
A
signature moment of any Farrelly brother movie.
Here's the thing that's most interesting about this. So Peter Farrelly made Green Book sandwiched between two seasons of a television show called Loudermilk. Farrelly developed a show called Loudermilk, which is a TV series, about a guy who's in AA, who's a horrible, horrible, tell-it-like-it-is human being. The entire show is based around the idea that every word that comes out of this guy's mouth is something you probably shouldn't say to somebody. That show is so good and so honest that you watch one season of Loudermilk, then you watch Green Book, which is so fake and so manufactured, and then there's season two of Loudermilk, where he's right back to telling the truth. It's amazing to me that somebody is capable of doing these things. Because Green Book is really just a let's make everyone feel good movie, whereas Loudermilk is we don't care what
you
think.
Or as we call it in the biz, Oscar bait.
Yep. Oh, and it was one of it was like much like Crash. It was an absolute Oscar bait movie that the moment it won the Academy Award, everyone said, "What? That syrupy piece of garbage?" And it's every couple of years we get one where we give a best picture
the
out.
Driving Miss Daisy for the 21st century?
I don't have that much trouble with Driving Miss Daisy, but what was the film it beat that everyone freaked out about? That's the real question. I don't remember. I think it's 89.
I already forget.
Yeah, but Driving Miss Daisy was definitely one of those, but I didn't hate that one as much.
No, it's just a mildly pleasant little film.
It's a little cynical. That's the thing hate about it.
But, you know, it's not like, and this was the best thing that it came out all year.
It gave Morgan Freeman another chance to be sassy.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, isn't that all we really want in life? A chance to see Morgan Freeman be sassy? Still a fan of that guy. He's got it going on. Well, we're definitely out of time to bring up another directing duo, even though I have 40 more to talk about. So in the future episode, we will come back to this topic. But I'm glad that we got in the two guys who did A L'Intérieur, and I'm really happy to give them a shout out anytime, because everybody who can put up with the most extreme movie ever made should probably see that movie, A L'Intérieur.
It's up there among them.
It is worth noting that about 2 years ago, they did an American remake of this film,
which you should not see.
Stays true to the source material for about 20% of the film, and then softens every single act of violence towards the end.
Yeah, this is not a film that works if you soften it.
It's like, why on earth would you want to make a dumbed-down, quieter version of what is a balls-out exploitation film? There's no market for that. Much like the remake of Martyrs, which is shockingly close to the original, and then just starts making it lighter near
the
end.
Well, you need that version you can safely run on an airplane.
Yes, because Martyrs is definitely your go-to airplane movie. It's just the strangest choices that get made sometimes when the Americans say, let's fix this. I love the feeling this movie gave me. But
let's
make this
play in middle America.
Yeah, nobody needs to see that version of Inside. It's not relevant. It's a very strange choice overall. It's like, I guess,
is it up there with Spike Lee's Old Boy remake?
I preferred that.
Yeah,
I still think
and
the
you
Spike
can go
Lee's
straight to hell.
Spike
for that
Lee's
one.
Old Boy remake is a bad but interesting attempt to retell the same story. It's interesting. There's plenty of stuff that's in that movie that is not in the original. And I mean, most of it doesn't work, but it's still interesting.
Even though you like it, you have to appreciate it is the wimped out version of it.
Oh, on many levels. On many levels. There's no squid eating in it. Yeah, you can't get behind a non-squid eating old boy.
That moment alone in the original is more horrifying than any American remake of any Asian film.
Yes. Well, that's been it for Notable Directing Duos Not Named Cohen for this week. My name is Michael Brody. I've been joined today by Shane Simmons.
Who's
that? Oh, no. I've given away your secret identity. Do you have anything you want to plug super fast?
Yeah. Just came out with the ebook version of Petty Crimes and Vindictive Criminals, which is my collection of crime stories on Amazon.
All right. I have read them, and most of them were pretty good. All right, we're out of time for this week. We will be back next week, possibly with a sequel to this, and possibly with a full new topic. We'll see you then.